Welcome back to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Stanford physics and education professor Carl Wieman won a Nobel Prize for his groundbreaking work in quantum mechanics. These days, the Nobel laureate is trying to spark something of a teaching revolution in higher education, especially when it comes to science. Wieman wants to transform undergraduate education by improving teaching through methods called active learning. He's been interested in effective teaching strategies for years. His new book is Improving How Universities Teach Science, and Professor Wieman joins us now in studio. Welcome to Forum.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Good to talk to you again. Let's jump right into your critique of undergraduate teaching today. I mean, you argue that the well-established traditional large lecture format still used widely today across higher education is ineffectual. Why?
Doing research in this area like myself, I mean, we measure it and we just see that the learning that takes place is really minimal. And then if you dig into the way the brain processes and learns, it's pretty clear why it's so minimal. It's that to learn something, you really have to be processing those ideas. You got to, I think of it as sort of exercising the neurons in the brain, and sitting there listening to someone where it's just kind of flowing past you, you're not doing that mental processing, you're not exercising the brain, and you walk out without really learning anything.
The brain needs to grapple with these questions, struggle with them in order for the learning to really happen.
That's exactly right.
What did you find in your research when the traditional SAGE on the stage format was used? What percentage, roughly, of students were, you know, getting that knowledge and retaining it?
We've looked at a whole variety of different measures, but, you know, it's something like 10%, although it's more that it's not that 10% of the students are getting it. It's really that the average student is getting about 10% of what's being presented to them.
You write in your new book on this topic, it's next to impossible for prospective students to get any meaningful information on the quality of teaching at the institutions they're considering, end of quote. I mean, it's the job, Carl, of universities to teach. You're saying they don't really bother to measure how well they're doing. That seems kind of incredible.
What they measure are student evaluations at, you know, at the end of the course. And that's really, I mean, if you dig into this, that's overwhelmingly dominated by sort of personal appearance and characteristics and, you know, size of course. It's not really connected to how much the students are learning. It's not at all connected to the whether the instructor's using these method practices that we know are more effective at learning.
Clarify what you mean a little bit. What does it mean students on average learn 10% of, you know, what's presented? I mean, is that what they retain? How is that measured?
There's lots of different measurements you can do. And so, that's kind of a simplified view of things. But for example, in one case study we did, we had students go to these lectures and then we gave them sort of a pop quiz right at the start of the next class. And we saw, okay, how many of them, you know, what was their score on this quiz above random guessing? And it was about 10%. In other cases where people have looked at long-term retention, where you measure something a few weeks later, they see a very rapid drop-off. So even things like on a final exam, students can score high. 3 weeks later, that'll be down dramatically. That, you know, it's sort of just a very brief learning that goes away quickly.
We're talking with Stanford physics and education professor and Nobel laureate Carl Wieman about how to transform teaching in college. His new book is Improving How Universities Teach Science. Give us a call at 866-733-6786 for your questions for Carl Wieman. You can call us at 866-733-6786 or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. And Carl, talk a little bit about why universities aren't doing more to measure effective teaching. Is it the system that's been set up, the publisher-perish cliche? What?
Yeah, I mean, it's a system that just sort of grew haphazardly, and we end up with, I mean, really it grew before the printing press was invented, and the structures like the lecture were how to transmit information to people who didn't have books. And then universities are a little slow to change. You know, printing press came along and we're still adjusting to it. But
the focus on research and tenure instead of effective teaching strategy. So, I mean, right now colleges aren't, they don't really know how well they're doing.
That's right. I mean, you know, at least in the big range of colleges, but you look at sort of the big research universities, the Stanford University of California sort of dominate the system. They have very detailed, careful systems for measuring research and rewarding it, and they don't have anything like that for teaching. And so the incentive system has just gotten completely warped to research productivity, and people just need to start recognizing their are more effective ways of teaching. There are ways to measure that. And it's, in part, that's a research result that we have over the last couple of decades and needs to come into how our system works.
You write in your book about one example, the Science Education Initiative that's trying to change that through techniques known as active learning. Talk a little bit about that for those who don't know what it is. How is that instruction in the classroom different from the big lecture sage on the stage?
Sort of research-based active learning is about is you take the thinking that you really want students to learn, you know, how does a physicist think about a problem or a chemist and so on, and what decisions do they make? And then you break that problem down into sort of student bite-sized pieces, and you give them to the students to work on. They usually work in small groups. The instructor's sort of monitoring how the students are thinking, what's right, what's wrong. And then we'll periodically pull them back together every 5 or 10 minutes to discuss how they're coming along, give them feedback on what thinking's right or wrong. So it's very much a process of practicing the thinking and getting feedback on it, just like you'd go to, you know, if you wanted to learn to play a sport, that's exactly what we do.
So the professor in this case is more of a coach. He's walking around the room, he or she, and actively trying to engage the students. What are they having? What are they struggling with? Where can that person's knowledge help them get over a hump? That kind of thing?
That's exactly right. And they're doing the other thing a coach does is they break down, you know, performance in a field and into right kind of practice exercises, you know, dribbling with your left hand and focus on mastering that and then putting it together in the same way. So very much I sort of like a cognitive analog to a coach.
What about the tenured professor who says, look, I put a lot of time, energy, and effort into my lecture. You got to be there. You got to listen. You got to take notes. This is based on years of my research and my work. I've written this. And this is an important part of pedagogy, of my teaching, is this lecture. You're essentially saying bunk. It's not effective.
I'm saying, you know, if you just have to measure the results and you see that, tradition doesn't always mean that something's right.
Thousands of years we've had the lecture.
Yeah, that's true. And partly it's, you know, the students are changing. Partly it's the kind of thinking's changing. We're trying to teach students to think about much more complex things, science and engineering, and that demands a different way of teaching than if, you know, this is an edible fruit and that one isn't, that you're trying to let your kids in the jungle survive.
We're talking with Stanford professor, Nobel laureate Carl Wieman about changing the way higher education teaches. Give us a call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. And Carl, you're talking about a big undergraduate research universities and changing that approach. But are your techniques and your ideas around active learning applicable as well to the humanities, someone teaching Shakespeare, art history, or for that matter, a K-12 teacher out there?
So that gets to be a more complicated issue. And I would argue on the basis of the research on learning that they're almost certainly apply to most of the humanities because you can identify, you know, like a historian, how they think about things, how they evaluate sources, et cetera. They have very much clear expert decision-making processes and everything. We have that. We know how to teach those better. But we don't have people in those fields who have tried them in the classroom.
You don't have the data, but you're pretty sure it works as well.
Yeah, that's right. We have data on sort of the fundamental learning processes, but I can't point to a history course like I can physics and show you this class learned this way, that class learned that way, and see they learned twice as much in this class.
What about K-12? I mean, again, we probably don't have the research or the numbers, but when you're talking to a science educator, 8th grade science or 12th grade biology, can he or she use these techniques as well to get more out of their students?
Yes. I mean, we do have some research from K-12, and the basic ideas certainly apply down to quite low grade levels. It gets more complicated because there's a lot of other factors that come into a K-12 classroom, as you know, that affect what students are doing and thinking and learning. And so that sort of makes the implementation tricky. The other thing that makes it quite tricky is that these methods really require a greater level of expertise in the teacher. Mm-hmm. They have to understand the subject at a deeper level to teach it effectively with these methods. And, you know, a lot of our K-12 teachers didn't come out of college with that depth of knowledge of the science they're supposed to be teaching.
A lot of calls coming in. You can weigh in at 866-733-6786. Should more colleges and universities try to measure teaching effectiveness? What do you think about eliminating the college lecture? And how did you learn best in college? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. We're going to go to the phones. Bill, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I was a professor for some 35 years in the CSU system and a department chair. And at Cal State Northridge, we had a general meeting of all the deans and all the department chairs, and they outlined a new set of administrative policies, and I objected. I simply said that it was impossible to educate students given the new implementation procedures they were suggesting. And I was told very directly by the provost of the university back in the 1990s, Bill, our job is not to educate. Our job, mandated by the governor and the legislature, is to graduate. We're expected to graduate people as quickly and cheaply as possible. And the best way to do that is en masse. We really don't care if they're learning the material. We care that they graduate.
Bill, thanks for your call. Carl, he gets to a good point about administrations not really supporting what folks are doing in the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, ultimately, I think our society cares about what students are learning. And, you know, it's just about good management to make sure people are really looking at what they are learning and best supporting their learning.
But good management is key, and you're talking about getting principals, getting administrators, and at the higher ed level, I guess, provosts and presidents on board as well, and that can be a struggle.
That's right. But, you know, in my book, I talk a lot about this big initiative where we really looked at what was involved in structuring, making a university move towards adopting in a widespread basis all of these better teaching methods. And yeah, there's a lot of pieces you have to put in place, just like you do for any change, any big organization.
I mean, talk about that. It did take a lot of work to spread these changes across the university to get them to adopt these techniques.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's go to some more calls. Grace in San Francisco, you're on Forum.
Oh, hi. My name is Grace. I teach at San Francisco State University. I want to know how you think screens are impacting learning in the classroom. And do you think education and teaching might be different for this millennial generation?
Thanks. Sorry, what was the first part?
Screens. What sense are screens affecting teaching and learning from your perspective, Carl?
Yeah. So, you know, these new technologies can be helpful, but generally they're bad in that they distract people. And one of the things that's very easy to demonstrate in studying learning is a distraction. Splitting your attention between two things, your brain processes it stuff in very different ways, and the amount of learning just drops precipitously. So basically, when those kids are in that classroom and they're switching their attention back and forth between their cell phones, the internet, and what's happening in the classroom, I can just guarantee you the learning as turns out almost zero as soon as that happens.
We're speaking with Professor Carl Wieman from Stanford, and a listener writes in, the lecture as backbone of pedagogy was instituted as a way of getting around the difficulty of making books. I think books, short lectures available online, short quizzes, and problems solved with the instructor and other students work better. Another listener writes in, I spent most of my life in the science field. I taught science and math at the university level. Professor Carl Wieman's idea is nonsense and extremely harmful to higher education. Nothing can replace the lecture and the interaction between the teacher and students. Your response to that, Carl, that, you know, people like the lecture.
People who are giving the lecture like the lecture, and people who give lectures. I mean, I look at why do people get so attached to lectures. And one thing is, okay, you know, it's nice to have a captive audience listening to you. They have their sort of self-identity wrapped up in being a good performer as lecturer. Mm. But, you know, I always challenge them, well, let's measure how much your students are learning, just like I did. When I gave lectures and I started measuring, and boy, was that a shocking experience.
Well, you've called lectures the pedagogic equivalent of sort of medieval bloodletting, which seems kind of harsh, but...
Well, you know, bloodletting for a long time, or 2,000 years, it was the treatment of choice, and we had good justifications. We, you know, people treated with bloodletting and they recovered. And so people go to lectures and they come out, you know, from their education, seem to learn something. You got the same rationale. And it's only when you start doing careful studies and measurements, controlled comparisons, you realize just how flawed these things are. And that's kind of studies that have really only happened in the last couple of decades. And so a lot of this research just hasn't percolated out to the science.
Only in the last couple decades. Interesting. Devin in San Francisco, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Hi. I had sort of a two-parter. One is that the technique that you were describing as kind of active learning reminded me significantly of like the Socratic method. And I wondered sort of like how that got removed, you know, predating the printing press itself. And the other is whether any of your research overlaps with some of the sort of motivational learning stuff from Carol Dweck, Stanford's Carol Dweck, and her research into self theories.
Devin, thanks for your call. Carl, take the first one.
Yes. So you raised two very good points. So the Socratic method, it's a little vague as to what it really means in practice. I mean, in some ways, and often the way Socrates did it, it didn't really involve the students thinking very much. It was just posing questions to them as a way to structure a lecture, if nothing else. But to the extent it's used to really have the students think about and process the ideas and build on it, then that's quite consistent with what the research shows is helpful.
And the second point from Devin on the research and motivations of learning and Carl Dweck.
Yeah. So Carol. This goes into some a variety of aspects of, I'll say, the sort of social and psychological aspects of learning, is that what we know is to learn effectively from these methods, you have to kind of believe that you're learning and how to go about learning as a student. And so, Carol's work and others help recognize there are sort of basic barriers in a student's beliefs that can interfere with that. If they don't think they can learn math, they won't learn math. Mm-hmm. And you have to recognize and address those sorts of issues to be an effective teacher. And so there are these... I would say things like that and dealing with them are kind of enablers to this kind of cognitive practice that we look at.
We're talking with Nobel laureate Carl Wieman, a physics and education professor at Stanford. His new book is Improving How Universities Teach Science. And Alexander writes, why are the observations about learning limited to science? What's needed to improve teaching in other domains? And Alexander's question gets to the idea that, you know, this research is really, as you said, only in the last decade or two.
Yeah. And it's also... I mean, it's now starting. We have lots of data now from science and engineering across all those fields and all levels. It's starting to leak out or spread out some into the social sciences. I've seen some good papers from economics and political science, psychology. But, you know, into the humanities, I think partly they're just not used to thinking about doing experiments and doing controlled experiments like we do in science routinely. And that's just kind of the culture of the disciplines.
Chris in Palo Alto, you're on the air. What's your question for Carl Wahman? Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I haven't heard the whole show, so I apologize. I just tuned in, but I just wanted to throw in a thought. My master's degree is in the humanities. I understand that you're sort of making a distinction there that may not apply, but I just wanted to say that in my experience, both as a student and as a instructor, that this kind of data-driven across-the-board generalization is actually unrealistic and can be harmful. I'm not saying that your guest is wrong, but I think that it's just a much more nuanced issue. And in my experience, it's the quality of the lecture that really makes a difference, not the fact that it is a lecture. I think that an ample question and answer period, appropriate and engaging visual aids, these are the things that allowed me to retain the information that I received in lectures. I'll take the response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I would have believed that 25 years ago until I started collecting more and saw other people collecting more and more data. You know, it basically, I changed my belief based on the evidence that we accumulated when we were just measuring what students across many different classrooms, many different kinds of courses and so on.
Data doesn't lie.
The data was just quite compelling. Now, you know, do I have data on that from the humanities? I don't. And certainly they may have different sorts of lectures in those. And so I'm not going to make those claims.
Well, Samantha writes in, some of the best teachers I've ever had were not in universities, but in community colleges where the emphasis is on teaching and learning as opposed to research and prestige and tenure. The best researchers are often not the best educators, she writes. She gets to an important point about how the university is structured these days.
Yeah, I all I can say is, yeah, that's the way it is.
Good point. Allison, in San Francisco, you're on forum. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much. Yes, I am a two-time entrepreneur, started two companies, and used to teach at Parsons School of Design, and looking to do teaching again, go back to teaching. And one of the things that hit me today that you said was this active learning. And as a design teacher and a design researcher myself, I'm finding it a bit challenging to get back into the university world. They're not even looking at people like us who've been in the real world. And that is one issue. And then the other issue is, you know, as a design strategist and design thinker, are you looking into bringing that? Is that really what your active learning in your book is about? Because this is natural for us. You know, designers work that way naturally, the way that you guys have been suggesting in your talk.
Thanks, Allison. Appreciate the call. And Carl, you know, design thinking is big at Stanford. It partly originated.
Yeah, I would say it's not quite the same. Design thinking is a little, it goes in a somewhat different direction and a little vaguer in some respects than what we're looking at. So while there's some overlaps, there are, I would say, some significant differences as well.
And Larry in Fremont, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, my name is Larry. I'm an engineer. I've been in the electronics industry for about 30 years. And I noticed when I got out of school that I didn't really know the material that I'd learned. And I really learned it in my first job or two, where you actually got to do the things and work with the concepts that you were taught. And I've also observed that when I hire people, students coming from universities that focus on hands-on methods of teaching know the material much better than students that come from institutions that focus more on the academic and lecture-based approach. So So I'll take responses off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
So, Larry, you're coming from exactly the same direction I came to this 30 or so years ago, in that I was surprised how the students coming in as graduate students in my physics research lab, they'd done great in all these courses, but they didn't seem to be able to know how to do physics. And I think this is much the same thing that you're talking about. And it was when I really started getting interested in studying that phenomena, I came to realize that, yes, the way we were teaching and the way we were testing students really wasn't capturing any of the more complex thinking skills that you want in really doing these things. And so that sort of led the observations just like yours led me to the realization of how we can embody that kind of thinking and the learning of that kind of thinking into our regular teaching. And so and so that's basically sort of a guide of where this all came from, is how do we turn them into or move them more like real experts in thinking about the subject in the ways we teach?
Carl, what universities are starting to look at this holistically, try to change how they measure and conduct research on teaching effectiveness?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because it's so unusual for people to look at real measures of teaching effectiveness. So, you know, in my book, I talk about Colorado and British Columbia, where we led big programs and that
structured the Science Education Initiative.
Yeah. To do that. And so there's particularly at University of British Columbia, and there's now much more extensive data as well as much more extensive use of these practices. At a lot of other places, there's, you know, discussion about it. They'll have individual faculty, but I don't know of any real large-scale efforts yet.
Carl, briefly, do you think university presidents and provosts are listening to you and reading these kind of books to look at this?
Not much. I mean, I'm always struck by when I talk with administrators and sort of I get lots of requests to go speak mm-hmm. at places, and I sort of have the requirement if I'm going to come, they got to make sure I get to talk to the president or provost, just add a little push. But I'm always struck by how little awareness they have that there really are measurements of different ways to teach and what's effective and not effective. It's certainly not in the qualification to run a university to know anything about learning, unfortunately.
Well, on that slightly pessimistic note, we've run out of time. We've been talking with Nobel laureate Carl Wieman, a physics and education professor at Stanford University. His new book is Improving How Universities Teach Science. Carl, thank you for coming in.
A pleasure. Thanks.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Eric Westervelt. Michael Krasny returns Tuesday. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.